Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is Podcast 367, The New Talk. I'm down here in the studio because, once again, it is inhospitable outside. The rain is pouring down. The trees are blowing. It's that cold May rain where it feels like winter, but it's not. You know, it's just, eh. So I'm down here in the studio with the wonders of technology at my fingertips, and so I think we should bring in the fire, and we'll just use the fire as kind of a background in this podcast, because I feel like I want to have a background. So cue the fire. Ah, much better. I feel like this podcast needs to have a background. Because there's actually a lot to talk about from the news over the weekend. And to get you ready for the week, there's a few things I think need to be pointed out. First of all, an election in Britain has all the pundits wagging their tongues. What conclusion should we draw from the election in Britain regarding American politics? Governor Scott Walker waded into foreign policy this weekend, and while he got a big applause, it was not good in my view. There's a lot of talk about technology amplifying the individual in ways we don't expect. As you guys know, I talk about this stuff all the time. I'm super passionate about it because it involves the nature of work. And some people don't like it, especially when I talk about California freelancers in the entertainment business, because the entertainment business is the devil, of course. But the fact is that the Los Angeles freelance model, basically for Hollywood, is kind of bleeding out into new apps and companies sprouting up to make it easier for the 1099 or freelance worker across the world and across America to change the nature of work in this country and the world. So I'll talk about that and update that in this podcast. Also, if there's time, some ideas for organizing in your neighborhood, some issues to organize around in Podcast 367. Well, as you know, xgovernmentcars.com is the oldest sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcast. Ed started sponsoring the podcast way back in 2009 when I first started, when nobody even knew what a podcast was. And so I'm pleased to let you know that the X Government Cars grand reopening event is on. It's continuing. And here's the whole thing. Ed Johnson has been doing this for a long time. He's been buying government-maintained cars and selling them to people for a long time, and now he knows where all the places to get the kick-ass former cop cars are. So he has nicer, newer vehicles. We're talking about Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, plus, you know, SUVs like the Yukon or the Suburbans, vans. And eventually they will have the new Ford SUV as well that the police all have. They're great. They will snap your neck. They're just super kick-ass. They're great. But the main thing is great financing for all levels of credit at xgovernmentcars.com. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Everybody gets approved. X Government Cars only carries one owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles. I have now had four of them, including the kick-ass podcast ambulance, which goes under the name of the Mobile Podcast Command Unit 8. So let's review. Cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson, so he'll negotiate. Two, a three-day satisfaction guarantee. So if you don't like the car, just bring it back. Financing for all levels of credit, and you can apply 24/7 safely and securely at xgovernmentcars.com, and you can go out to visit as well, 2420 Nevada Avenue North in Golden Valley. Don't forget the grand reopening event is on now at xgovernmentcars, xgovernmentcars.com. Everything is better, and yes, I do have the bullhorn. So here we go. Everything is better at
xgovernmentcars.com.
So what's the most important story heading into the next week that we have, the week of, I guess, May 11th? It's not the cops getting shot, although that doesn't minimize it. It's not so-called conservatives abandoning Draw Muhammad creator Pam Geller because she's too controversial, although that's pretty interesting. It's not the cattle call of presidential candidates braying their way into the headlines, except for one this week. Not even President Obama's crocodile feud with his pal Elizabeth Warren over over the free trade authority thing is worth talking about. No, what has got me fired up is the British election, in particular, what people are saying about it. Now, I'm just going to do a little disclaimer. I am certainly no expert on British politics, and I actually think that there's a lot of people talking about it that really don't know what the hell they're talking about when it comes to British politics. But this is what I'm fired up about. All of the smart-ass pundits and pollsters thought the left was going to win the big election in the UK last week, and imagine their shock when the Conservatives really came pretty close to destroying the left. Now, intellectually speaking, I've been telling you for a long time that polling and pollsters, I think, and reporters are becoming too famous to the point where they become the story or put themselves inside the story rather than simply being a pollster, you know, in the traditional sense, wearing a short sleeve white work shirt, you know, a black knit tie, horn rimmed glasses, pocket protectors, and all that stuff, standing there at the train station with the clipboard. Now they're TV stars, and once they begin to love the sound of their voice and the sight of their appearances on Fox News and CNN and the networks, they lose their ability to be objective or be perceived as being objective in any way. And what happens is, and I think the key word when it comes to some of these polls and pollsters is, actually it's two words, confirmation bias. Because polling isn't so much a science as it is an art, especially when it comes to politics. Especially when it comes to conclusions about what society thinks and what is a political trend. You don't want pollsters being telegenic. You don't want political scientists becoming pundits, because once that happens, what they say is worthless, even though it will be transmitted to the world. And this is what happened in Britain. And by the way, it happened in the 2014 cycle in the United States as well, because none of the pundits could predict the real victory that Republicans had in the House of Representatives. Now, to begin with, without getting too technical, Britain's system, my understanding of Britain's system, is officially called a constitutional monarchy. That is, Queen Elizabeth is the head of state and the prime minister is the head of government. Beyond that, Britain's political system is a parliament. And just for the purposes of this podcast, why not refer to Encyclopedia Britannica, which defines a parliamentary democracy as such, a democratic form of government in which the party or coalition of parties with the greatest representation in parliament, the legislature, forms the government, its leader becoming prime minister or chancellor. Executive functions are exercised by members of the parliament appointed by the prime minister to the cabinet. The parties in the minority serve in opposition to the majority and have the duty to challenge it regularly. The prime minister may be removed from power whenever he loses the confidence of a majority of the ruling party or of the parliament. Parliamentary democracy originated in Britain and was adopted in several of its former colonies. Now, that differs from the American Republican system of government, specifically because Americans felt that they had a bad experience with majority rule. So in a parliamentary system, the majority rules, while it might be said that the purpose of the republic is to limit the majority. So this is where we get these statements like rule of the mob and things like that. I mean, there are other differences, to be clear, but to me, these are the key differences. Parliamentary systems are also significantly different from a Republican system, as I said, and as Encyclopedia Britannica defined, that in the head of government's power, you know, it comes directly from the legislature. Parliaments can challenge and demand elections if the prime minister loses a majority, where in our system, we elect presidents separately through the people and the states, through the electoral college, and the people we elect have certifications and serve full terms. They, in other words, if they lose the majority, it doesn't mean that they lose their seats. The reason I mention this is none of these pundits are going to take the time to explain to you the differences in the systems. All you're going to hear in the next few weeks is how the election in Britain means such and such for America, and people are going to think the two systems are the same, and so we can draw these conclusions. They're really not, and they're very different. Obviously, the United Kingdom is a European country. America is North America, basically. You know, the United States is not a Northern European country. Moreover, so-called conservatives or Tories in the United Kingdom bear some similarities to so-called conservatives in the U.S., but I would not say that they necessarily would be Republicans in the United States. Same with the Labour Party or the lesser parties on the left in the U.K. They might not be Democrats here. If you're that interested, I suppose you'd be well served to read up on the positions of these parties and the policies they advocate in the United Kingdom, because they have different meanings and purposes than our supposed conservatives. And so the election in Britain has some definite local implications in Britain. I don't know that they can be extended to include the United States. That said, the new government will move very quickly to cut back spending, particularly on welfare, continue the current economic policies of David Cameron, the Prime Minister, and the Tories, who now enjoys a sizable majority in the House of Commons, although not as big in the House of Lords, is my understanding, which many people in this country can identify with. Basically, it would be like having a huge majority in the House and a thin majority in the Senate. Now, people like Larry Jacobs at the University of Minnesota, another pundit enamored of the sound of his own voice and local go-to guy for political questions, will bend over backwards to tell you that the British will now work together, and that this shows the kind of problem we have in our country with weak political parties is that we don't work together and it's gridlock, and this is the standard nonsense that is going on in this country. We have more to fear from bipartisan political action in the House and the Senate than we do from quote-unquote gridlock. But you'll never hear these pundits say this. The truth is that Cameron, who is the Prime Minister of England, has been working with the left because he has not had a working conservative majority in the House of Lords, and that's going to change now that there is a more conservative majority in both houses, even if the majority is slimmer in the upper house in Britain, and you're going to see suddenly a lot more dissent and a lot less bipartisanship in the UK because of those majorities. What's the most significant thing? I think what's significant about this is the fact that the people in Britain told the pollsters one thing and did another when it came to voting. Even the Tories' own polling understated the victory. The lesson for pundits and political junkies in this country is polls say the country, the United States, is moving left. But they may not be getting the real story, because pollsters and pundits are still asking questions that come from operating on the old right-left paradigm. Republicans are this, Democrats are that. And things could be changing. Moreover, people who don't agree with the left's standard vision are so beaten down. And this came up in some of the analysis of what happened in Britain, because you're not allowed to disagree with the left socially. So people just keep their opinions to themselves. But we still have a vote in these countries in the West. And sometimes people surprise those who think they know everything. And this happened here in 2014, and it could happen in 2016. Very quickly, you know, I mentioned that I spoke in front of a group of Republicans recently, and the chairman of the Minnesota Republican Party came up with this, hey, a poll shows people moving to the left, and how are we supposed to deal with that? And I said, well, I would question the poll, first of all, but the other side of the coin is that I guess what it means is you should let the individual candidates run the races that they want to run. And he said, that's what we did. Well, to correct that answer, they sort of did that, but the Republican Party also put a lot of money into the races they wanted to win, and that was a key question. The other thing is, it's important to point out that everywhere else in America, with the exception of Minnesota, people move to the right. They voted for Republicans, and Minnesota is the only place where that supposedly didn't happen. So I think the polls are showing one thing, and people are voting in a different direction. And so people on the right who are politically active should remember that. I think to a large degree, people who live in so-called democratic countries have about had it with policies that they're told are going to work, and the constant spin when they don't. Our economy is not growing. Social policies are not working, and order is breaking down at the breaking points. For example, the riots in Baltimore and in Ferguson, with people who are really on the edge of society. People are essentially bearing up under all of this, and they are adapting. But I would say to the politician, woe to he who ignores the fact that they are getting pretty upset under the skin about this stuff. And they're not going to express it in the kind of language pollsters and pundits are going to understand, especially if they're asking questions to lead a specific set response because of an old moth-eaten perception of politics. A lot of what is going on out there is very fluid. A lot of politics in this country depends on what is said. It depends on personalities and issues in progress course, at election time. And one of the things I said to Keith Downey at the speaking thing was, you know, this doesn't preclude a really gifted politician running for governor. We were talking about Minnesota, who really can bring all this together. And I think that's the one thing that people aren't necessarily thinking about. And I would say that the lesson from the UK election is, regardless of what is being written about Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush or Scott Walker or any of the other 46 people running for president, I would say all bets are off. We will see, you know, what issues come up, and we'll see how those issues drive the responses and party affiliations. Right now they're saying Republicans have this many people behind them and Democrats have this many people, and it's all about money. And basically, it's an echo chamber. They're just repeating the same analysis over and over again. And I'm not sure, and this is what I talked about when I talked about driving across the country, I'm not sure if people are, you know, necessarily bought in to those punditry kinds of analyses. The other thing to note, I think, from the UK election is when the left loses, they always fall back on the old, it's a systemic problem argument, where they want to tinker with the electoral system, or they'll complain about, you know, what happens when there's no bipartisanship or too much bipartisanship or the limits of a parliamentary or Republican system. It's very interesting to me that they're arguing in Britain about how they need to change the parliamentary system to be more representative, while here they're arguing that we need to have a more parliamentary system as opposed to a Republican system. The bottom line is that they're full of it on both sides of the proverbial pond. The only thing to do with the left is to give them a good old-fashioned ass-whipping at the polls and to keep doing it, and that's the only way that you'll get the Democrats or the left to conciliate with Republicans. So this was a weekend in which, speaking of Republicans, the Republican candidate showed up at another one of these cattle calls, this one in the Carolinas somewhere, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker got big applause with a speech on foreign policy. Now, Walker has great street cred after the political battle he's been through in Badger State with the unions. What he said was, on behalf of our children and mine, I want a leader that is willing to take the fight to them before that they take the fight to us. He was referring to the Islamic State. Now, I've started to hear this in Republican circles lately, and it really surprises me. For example, you have Jeb Bush this weekend also talking about Christianity and how he would have supported the original invasion of Iraq and so forth. Never mind that I told you that Bush would wrap himself in the cloak of religious fundamentalism, even though he is a converted Catholic, because the idea is to make you think that he's conservative, and a lot of Republicans are going to take this bait. And you have former Minnesota Senator Kennedy touting the concept that there is a new foreign policy school that's kind of interventionist, but not really. It's kind of libertarian. It's somewhere between realism and the liberal school when it comes to diplomacy. And what I've been hearing in a lot of these meetings is, yeah, we need to send troops over there to beat ISIS. Something needs to be done. Honestly, this supports my contention that we still don't have a Republican reason to have people to vote Republican. Now, my response to this is, how many troops do you want to send? Where do you want to send them? And what are they going to do? Are you sending them to Syria? You're going to have a response from Iran on that. Are you going to send them into Iraq again? I don't think that's going to work with the American people. It's not a winning strategy. And what Walker is saying is basically reinvade Iraq, which is a non-starter. People say, well, then what should we do? First of all, and I suppose this is a realist approach, but I don't care about the people in the Middle East, because really they've not demonstrated too much concern for the United States. The bottom line is that if you want to talk about the invasion of Iraq, and I've talked about this in a couple of podcasts, we tried to take a country at least susceptible to democratic governance, you know, Iraq being one of the most educated states in the Middle East at the time, you know, remove the worst dictator in the world, with the exception of the Sungs in North Korea at the time, and they screwed it up. The Shiites suppressed the Sunnis, and they reignited this tribal battle between the two groups. And this is a tribal culture, tribe and family and clan first. ISIS is nothing more than a group of former Saddam Hussein officers in his regime who have applied their skills to organization and created an organization that takes advantage of the Sunni fears of Shia control of the region. So that's what's going on. And if you send troops into that, it's not going to necessarily solve that problem. We're just going to be back in the same box that we were in. But what's changed since 2004? Well, First of all, the United States is and will be the world's largest oil producer for some time. So we are now the swing producer, which essentially drives a stake into the heart of OPEC. So we don't need to be in the Middle East anymore to exert huge influence in the region. Now, we certainly should support our allies. But I think we should take the strategy of saying, let's divide and conquer. If you guys want to fight, then go ahead and fight. We will let you fight. But we will protect our interests and our allies fiercely. For example, I think that we should make sure that the oil in the region remains on the world markets. But I think we should leave ISIS or whomever or whatever it is or will become to do whatever they want and protect our interests, which is our security, fiercely. Because unless you want to send, Republicans, a million troops there and destroy the region, killing hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions of people, and place all of it under a protectorate for the next 60 years, which is what we had to do at the end of World War II, for example, sending troops, and I have to put quotes around that, to fight ISIS, to take the fight to them, for example, is about the dumbest thing anyone can advocate for. And it's too bad that Walker took the bait on that. Last week, I mentioned an article in the New York Times on the nature of work. I mentioned podcast 348. It's an interview with a freelancer in LA. And the whole podcast was kind of based on my experiences in Los Angeles when I was out there in the mobile podcast command unit. Some people have an immediate knee-jerk reaction to anything that comes from Cali, which is really idiotic. I have to mention a Bloomberg.com piece by Katie Benner, White Collar Work to Get an Uber Disruption. And what she's talking about is companies and apps coming online to access white-collar professionals and people like administrative assistants to be available for people 15 minutes or so at a time to answer questions. So if you have a small business and you want to get somebody who's really a high-level accountant, this is something that you could sign up for, and for a price, you know, you could get 15 or 20 or 30 minutes of that person's time to help you figure out how to structure your business, for example. This is another example of how technology today, and it's increasingly doing this, amplifies the individual. And it's very disruptive, and it's changing everything. I'll tell you, they mention a website in the article. I don't need to tell you what it is, but the woman who actually administers the website lives in a small town in Mexico, where, you know, because she doesn't need to be in Silicon Valley or San Francisco or New York City. The system basically puts clients together with lawyers, just like Uber puts people who need rides together with drivers, accountants, administrative assistants, and other professionals and semi-professionals to solve problems. The bottom line is this is the nature of work in the future for everyone. And the reason I brought it up in Los Angeles was that usually the West Coast finds these solutions before the rest of the country. And people you know, including you, will be working this way in the very near future. And it's going to change a lot. And I mention it because the people running our country and our state think that we're all going to be taking the train downtown. We're all going to be working in glass towers, when in reality, we're going to be sitting in jeans in Mexico or Idaho or someplace like that, or working where we want, when we want, on what we want to be working on, and perhaps even making more money. So the whole corporate structure that we've come to be familiar with, including government, is really, its days are numbered. And I have so much passion for it. I guess what I'm saying is I don't have the words to fully express how strongly I feel about this. Finally, you know, I talk a lot about political organization in these podcasts. In fact, I'm going to be talking about, we've moved the Apple Valley Tea Party speech to June because of Memorial Day. And I'm going to talk a lot about the technology and amplifying the individual, but as well as political organization. And I think a lot of people out there think that when you talk about political organization, it means going door to door with a giant R painted on your forehead. And I've become enamored of these almost micro movements in various suburban areas. And I will talk specifically about Minnesota, but this can apply to any state. And I want to mention that there are several local issues in different parts of the metro, and wherever you live, this is true, whatever the issue is, that people can organize on. And I'm going to mention some of these, especially when it comes to Minnesota and the Minneapolis and St. Paul metro. Metro, because what it enables you to do is get to know neighbors, some of whom may be Democrats or Republican. They may not agree with you on other issues, but it's a chance to get together and be good citizens together. The first issue is Common Core, which there's lots of opposition to on the right and left in this country, and that means connecting with people at school board meetings and elections, knocking on doors, and talking about Common Core. Maybe your kids play hockey together, and you can start talking about that stuff. Second is all these sports facilities being built across the metro by these suburban city councils, which seem to be disconnected from the people who elected them in Eden Prairie, Woodbury, and others, where they're building entertainment centers and sports complexes for tens of millions of dollars. Really miniature examples of Viking stadiums. And they're using tax dollars to do it. And they're really expensive. And as soon as people find out how much they're costing, you know, the taxpayer, it's a ready-made organizing door-to-door issue. Third, there are a lot. In fact, one of the articles I read, they were talking about one of the towns that built some, you know, ridiculously expensive sports center. And by the way, it also extends to city halls. I was recently with a friend at a suburban meeting on a local issue similar to this, and we were at City Hall, so we were walking through City Hall, and he happens to be the mayor of a small town, and they meet in basically a pole barn, you know, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's a temporary type structure, and you know, he was just like, wow, you know, this place is amazing. And I thought, you know, look, as soon as you build an $18 million City Hall, then you got to fill it with an employee and employees, and then it starts costing even more money. So it's really interesting to see these really expensive facilities that these towns build, and it costs taxpayers a lot of money, whether they bond it or whether they use tax dollars to pay for it. And it's that, well, oh, these, we call them amenities. This is an amenity. It's building an $18 million City Hall is not an amenity. You know, it's not an amenity for me. It's an amenity for the City Hall. You know, that doesn't mean you can't build a new City Hall, but I think these are great issues to organize on, you know, when they go overboard, and they always do. The third issue is there's a lot of small towns in ex-urban areas fighting the tyrannical Met Council and its water policies, complete streets development and train crap and bike trail crap, and a lot of people who oppose this stuff don't show up at the weird right-wing meetings, and you might not know that they oppose this stuff. And so there's great opportunities for people to organize on these great local issues, all chances for you to meet your neighbors and help each other out and have the experience of working together on something. And then in future election cycles, you know, come 2016, for example, when you go door-to-door, they open the door and they know you because you're not the weird guy down the street who goes to the crazy meetings. You're the guy that helped them with the village board thing that you kind of came together on. They might not agree with you, but they're not going to slam the door in your face. And I think that's the kind of stuff that when citizens ignore what we're told we're supposed to think about stuff and start, put away the dogma and start working on issues that we agree on, working together on issues that we agree on. For example, you know, being forced to pay for milfoil removal, let's say, if you live on a lakeshore, or, you know, a school board referendum that is going to raise money to build an $18 million sports center or something. Those are the kinds of things that you can get together with your neighbors on, and it doesn't matter necessarily what end of the political spectrum they come from. It breaks you out of the Fox News and CNN and MSNBC paradigms and gets you working on local issues together. And then when the election comes, and you, like I said, you knock on their door and you say, hey, I'm really for this guy. I think he's great. They might listen to you and you might get a few votes out of that. It's called real citizenship. And taking advantage of the idea that people on both sides of the political spectrum have had it with the overbearing government on some level. You know, I mean, if I have a conversation with a liberal and I'm talking about overbearing government, the first thing I'm going to bring up is the surveillance state, because that's the thing that really gets under their skin on that. They might not be susceptible on economic issues or the welfare state, but when it comes to the NSA, you know, they can understand encroaching power of the state when it comes to things like that, or legalizing marijuana, let's say. So if we can put away the stuff that we absolutely inherently disagree on, then we can make a lot of headway in local communities. I mean, you may never get their vote, but the thing is, people are talking to each other, and that's the main thing. Plus, you're making some differences in local politics. And when it's done at a local level, I think it's a lot easier than when you get up to the state and the national levels. So those are some things going on in the news that I have kind of keyed on this weekend in Podcast 367. Thanks again to XGovernmentCars.com for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Yes, Ed has the kick-ass former police cars, Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, as well as trucks, vans, and SUVs. They will eventually have the kick-ass Ford police SUV. Great financing for all levels of credit, and you can apply online now safely and securely at XGovernmentCars.com. Everybody gets approved, and thanks, Ed, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. And yeah, I'll drag the bullhorn out one more time.
XGovernmentCars.com.
I want to thank the digital sponsor of the BobDavisPodcast.com, Mad Case Studios, creating quality original automotive artwork. And as I said before, Mad Case is going to be out at some of the antique auto shows this summer, and I'm going to tell you more as we get closer to the events. And maybe the Mobile Podcast Command Studio will be there as well. Click on the banners for more information about these digital sponsors, as well as all the sponsors of the BobDavisPodcast.com, right there at the top of the page at the BobDavisPodcast.com. Thank you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn, as well as blogtalkradio.com. Blog Talk Radio, just simply, there's an app there. It's just another way for you to listen to the podcast. If you want to use the Blog Talk Radio link, it will just directly, if you hit the player, it'll just play the podcast that's been last uploaded at Blog Talk Radio. Thank you guys for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and thanks for your donations at the Bob Davis podcast.com. Got a couple this weekend, and what I'm doing with that is going directly into the diesel fuel fund, and as soon as we get to a certain level, we're going to head back out again. I was over at the RV center this weekend, fired up Podcast Mobile Command Unit 8 and let it run for a while, charge up the batteries, make sure everything's good, and it is ready to roll and head out on the highway again. So thanks for your donations at the BobDavisPodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 367.
Hovering by my suitcase, trying to find a warm place to spend the night. Heavy rains are falling, seems I hear your voice calling, it's alright. A rain.